Hi, I'm Sharad Kutin. Welcome to Let's Talk, the show that's all about bringing you the most important conversations of the day. We're going to begin with a look at wages because that is something that goes to the heart of many of our lives. Yesterday, Khazanah Research Institute produced its State of the Household report, and that's spawned a conversation, in fact, many conversations. We're going to be speaking to Arul Chalvan. He is head of, or rather the part of the organizing committee of Gabungan Bantah Seribu Lima Puluh, or the coalition against the 1,500 ringgit minimum wage. We're also going to be looking at titles, and in particular the controversy sparked by Rina Harun, who is the Minister of Rural Development, when she said that getting a title, she's now Dato Sri, getting that title would help us serve the people better. We're going to be looking at some of the social chatter around that. Zayed Malik is going to be joining us. He's from Lawyers for Liberty. We're also going to be taking a deeper look at the perception of people about the economy and the government. And to help me with that, I have in the studio Ben Sufian. Ben Sufian is a coordinator, director, founder of Merdeka Center. He's such a familiar name that, of course, one doesn't have to introduce him. Thank you so much, Ben, for joining me today. I want to begin with the fact that Anwar Ibrahim, soon after he was, you know, sworn in as MP, I mean, one of the first, I think, statements he makes has to do with defending the government's record. It's a very new government. It's been, you know, criticised heavily for saying that the manifesto is something they cannot deliver on 100%. The perceptions out there, the media framing of those conversations, what do you know? As a pollster, what can you sense about the feelings of people about this government?
Well, you know, Sharad, first of all, thanks for having me here. And, you know, it's a great show. I think, first of all, what we noticed is that, you know, people entered the last election with a great deal of scepticism towards Pakatan Harapan, such that, you know, many people felt that, you know, Barisan Nasional somehow could pull through. But Pakatan Harapan made it. And it has gone through this and formed government. And to its credit, in the short space of time that it has had, I think it's created this imagination that reform is actually possible in Malaysia. And they had an ambitious to-do list in the manifesto.
Too ambitious by all accounts, by their own
acknowledgement is too ambitious.
Right.
But I think when we looked at public opinion surrounding the new government and what they had achieved, you know, at the point of 100 days, what we noticed was that I think in the first three major deliverables that they did, which was to repeal the GST, to address the issue about fuel subsidies, and then to take action on 1MDB. They had pretty much captured about 80% of what the public expected of them. And that is up to the point of 100 days. And then what we've noticed is that the thing has started to taper off. The reason is, as it gets into the business of, you know, running the country, running government, the friction is starting to build up. And also the issue of taxes has come into the picture.
Right, because there's the shortfall. Right,
yeah.
So they, in some ways, they are kind of victims of their own promises, right? They've taken away the GST. There's going to be a shortfall in terms of revenue. But before we get to that, I want to ask you about this thing. You said it was sceptical. There was a Malaysian sceptical about the possibility of their win. But were they sceptical about the message? Was the message something that they bought into? And how much political capital did Pakatan Harapan start off with?
Well, Pakatan Harapan started with that scepticism. But the message they brought to the public, which was to address the issue of 1MDB and the corruption and mismanagement of the previous government, I think that resonated with a lot of people. And the second thing that was, I think, critical in garnering the votes to win and cross the line was the fact that they put across a credible leader, you know, in the form of Dr. Mahathir. And Dr. Mahathir is the divisive figure, but it convinced enough people to give them the chance to run the country, and they got across the line. I think the challenge now is that to translate the mandate into something tangible. For the most part, I would say that since May 9th, 2018, Pakatan actually improved in terms of what we consider the popular vote. They won additional supporters. And so even if the sentiment towards how much it has achieved in terms of promises, you know, you get a lot of people arguing about it, for the most part, we find that there are still more people saying good things than bad things about Pakatan. So on the sum of things, they still have generated new political goodwill with the public. So they have a bit of a runway before they run out of that.
Okay, you know, we're talking, of course, about perceptions. We're talking about what's in people's minds. And people can turn on a dime. They could go from being fully supportive of a government and then the next day it changes, right? How do you, as a pollster, keep track of those trends? How do you make predictions about the future in terms of dynamics, in terms of, say, you know, when a political party might exhaust its political capital?
Well, I mean, we, on our part, we run monthly surveys. And for good or bad, the surveys does give an indication of where the public sentiment lies. And when we do these things, we try to be rigorous. We ask a lot of questions. And typically, we try to pin the government's performance not just on one or two indicators, but as many as 50, you know, even more than that. What we've noticed that with respect to Pakatan, it's running on two tracks. The urban base, younger people, largely non-Malay Malaysians, generally have very high regard for Pakatan. And so on that particular crowd, it has huge amount of goodwill. On the Malay Muslim, somewhat rural crowd, we notice that the traction is more limited. And so as we poll them from May until the end of last month, what we've noticed is that for the most part, it's been in positive territory. But since the introduction of the sales and service tax, there is some backlash amongst voters. Not as acute in the sense that it has not turned totally negative, but you can see that it has turned the curve. And slightly more people are negative now compared to before. So overall, you know, the government's overall approval rating at the end of September was around 57%. But the Prime Minister's rating is higher than that, 10% higher than that, at about 68. So there is a gap between the leader and the government.
Right. I mean, there are so many interesting issues, including the question of the public, right? You already started to segment it. You say there's an urban versus a rural, there's a Malay versus a non-Malay, Muslim, non-Muslim kind of issue there. But, you know, is there more than that? Are we, for instance, Sabah and Sarawak, do they constitute their own public? Does the east coast of the peninsula constitute a separate public? Or, I mean, is there a national picture that we can roughly say makes sense to talk about?
Well, we can say there is a national picture, but the national picture doesn't give you that kind of comfort when you speak to your friends that represents the general public out there. Because many of us, you know, we live in our own little cocoon of like-minded, you know, same socioeconomic status people, you know. So when we speak to our friends, we get a sense that everything's like that. No, the reality is not. So what we have is a composite picture of the country. But as we go into different regions of the country, different segments and age groups, we find people are assessing the government very, very differently. The young people, for the most part, are unified by the need to see the government address the issue of employment, wages. So what you talk about, this protest that's happening tomorrow, I think that's critical for a segment of the population. These people are not responding to politics as much as they are responding to the socioeconomic pressures that they face in daily life. So we actually have a very diverse public opinion landscape out there. But for that brief moment in May, everybody converged and gave Pakatan Harapan a chance.
Right. I mean, one of the things that interests me, and maybe you're not the person to ask, is do politicians and will politicians respond to this data? Will they start shaping public policy in order to kind of make the numbers a happier scenario than, you know, if they see it going south, for instance? But I do want to, before we go to a break, there was a polemic that emerged very soon after the elections around the Bangsa bubble. Now, is there reality behind the idea of a Bangsa bubble? Is there a segment of the population that is the Bangsa bubble? And do they respond and think and act in different ways?
Oh, certainly. I mean, there is a Bangsa bubble.
There is?
There is, definitely. And, okay. And you know, we've tried to kind of measure it. You know, in our scale, it only amounts to about 3% to 5% of the population. These are people that subscribe to very liberal social values, more liberal in terms of the political outlook, Western educated, and have high expectations on government moving towards a liberal democracy as one would see in the West or certain East Asian countries. The rest of the country is moving at different speeds and going in different directions. And
only 3 to 5%. That surprises me, because it seems that they're extraordinarily vocal, or they're extremely visible in the media, and they perhaps are punching above their weight in terms of influence.
Oh, certainly. I mean, because this is a group of citizens that are of high income. They are professionals in their own right, and some of them may lead groups, represent certain parts of the community that have an outsized voice in relation to their actual size. So they are quite influential in terms of connecting with leaders and getting their message out in the media. But what we've noticed is that there is contestation because of the internet and also how society is structured today. Even people in rural areas representing more conservative viewpoints are getting a place on the soapbox. They too can be heard. So there is a contestation for this.
Okay, we'll be back with more on that, and especially the chatter on social media. Social media, of course, a planet where the Bunker Bubble actually exists, I believe. We're going to be back with Zaid Malik from Lawyers for Liberty just after this break. Stay tuned to Let's Talk with me, Sharad Kutin. Hi, welcome back to Let's Talk with Sharad Kutin. That's me, of course, and my guests in the studio today are Ben Sufian from Merdeka Center. We are going to be talking about this little kerfuffle, and it, of course, was amplified on social media when Minister for Rural Development, Rina Harun of Bersatu, said that that getting a title, the title being Dato' Sri from the state of Malacca, was something that would help her serve the people better. In fact, it would encourage her. Now, she was pilloried for this. She was criticized for it because they said, well, you know, your motivations really ought to come from somewhere else. Now, on the line, we have Zaid Malik from Lawyers for Liberty. He weighed in on this. And Zaid, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I want to ask you why you, as a lawyer and working at Lawyers for Liberty, felt compelled to weigh in on this question.
Well, it's important, I think, as Lawyers for Liberty has always been a civil rights group, and we believe in the promise that Pakatan Harapan has brought to Malaysia in a form of new Malaysia. So when they have fallen back to this practice of accepting titles merely by their office, I think it harkens back to the time of the regime of the old.
Now,
so I think that is why it's important for us to chime in, yeah.
Right. Okay, well, that being what it is, I mean, there might be people who say, well, you know, it would be rude for her to decline the title, an offer of a title. Do you accept those kinds of arguments that are saying that, you know, we shouldn't, nitpick when it comes to Rina Harun's choices? She, of course, was one of 400 or so people who received titles from Malacca this time round. Do you think that's a valid argument?
I'm sorry, but I could not agree with her, because I feel like as a serving position and a serving minister who has only been in office for 5 months, she should have some sort of introspection. I don't think it would be rude for her to decline the award or the offer for the award, because that has been done before. And in fact, her colleague Rezwan has in fact declined the offer, so his claims were 3 times before this. So the issue of it being disrespectful to the state is a non-issue, and I don't think that she has the option whether or not to accept the award. But there is no compulsion here. She should have taken a principled stand and believe that serving ministers, especially a minister who is just green still in the office like her, to not have accepted this award, I would think.
Now, Kusu, we can turn our attention away from Rina Harun or all those others who accepted the awards to the state itself and the process. I'm going to refer to something that R. Nageswaran, because he's a well-known journalist who wrote an opinion piece in Malaysia Kini, and he said that in other countries, the process is very different. So it's very transparent. He made a reference to getting the Member of the British Empire or the MBE award. He says that the list that is produced, states the criteria. And actually, for everybody who's the recipient, it's very clear why they received it. Now, do you think we should shift the conversation away from why she accepted it to the process, and the process replicated across the Federation of giving titles?
Well, I guess it also plays a part. I mean, if the vetting process and the nomination is something that is transparent and done carefully, I think the nominees would not, I mean, like, there would not be any questions of, about the nomination or the people who get the awards. Of course, that is another method entirely that goes into looking into the system and seeing, I mean, there is a method of looking at the system as well. But I feel like that aside, I feel like a decision should be made to the serving politicians and the ministers, because it is, as the system as it currently stands, they can be nominated and they can have received the offer. So I feel like, as it stands right now, they should take the principled stand to not receive this nomination while they are still in office.
Now, I will make, again, reference to that piece that Nandiswaran wrote. He mentions several criteria, making a difference to the community, enhancing the country's reputation, long-term voluntary service, display of moral courage. These are just various reasons why you might achieve or get these things. What we do have in Malaysia often is a situation that we have no idea why somebody's received a datuk-ship or any of those titles. And often you see the media, you know, headlines like Dato involved in murder or Dato arrested and so on and so forth. Do you think that that we need a sea change? These titles, in fact, have been so degraded over time that they have their value has been lost?
Well, that is really an issue, because I would think, I mean, from my anecdotal experience, that the value of datuship or any other sort of title akin to it has somewhat devalued in the eyes of the public. So if the process of the nomination and the award is transparent and people can clearly see how these candidates are being selected, I would think that it would bring back confidence of the public to the awards, as well as the title conferred to these people who are to the people who are awarded the datuship or something like that.
Right. You know, one of the interesting things that was mentioned in that column was the fact that in India in 2015, politicians were stopped from, you know, recommending or nominating people. It now comes from the public. The general public is allowed to nominate people for these titles. Do you think that in Malaysia we would have a very open and a non-partisan process where people kind of nominate who they think is important?
I think taking a step towards that would be beneficial in regards to the titles, the system of awarding titles and awarding titles, because I feel like the public should have, at least if it comes from the public, then the public would know why these people are nominated. And I would think that if these nominations came from the public, it would be, I mean, the public would be the best judge of who has benefited their society or who has come and helped them the most among everyone else. Because the current nomination, as it stands, comes from the internal for political parties or the internal ministries involved when it comes to nomination process. So I feel like if we were to take a step away and give the power to the public to give nominations, it could be a good thing. But of course, the system has to be smoothened out, because of course there are like millions of people in Malaysia. So if we were to adopt that process, it would be good, but the system has to be worked out.
Right. Thank you so much, Zaid. That was Zaid Malik from Lawyers for Liberty weighing in on the Rina Haroon kerfuffle. I say it's a bit of a storm in a teacup. Do you think it's something that, you know, again, come back into the Bangsa bubble, that people who are hyper-conscious about, you know, questions of political culture, for instance, and want to see a change, they're the ones going to be most vocal on issues like this?
Well, you know, Sharad, when we look at this particular elections, it's quite clear that people didn't really make their judgments for candidates whether the person had or does not have a title. People looked at authenticity, whether they embodied certain values that could change the country for the better. I think in the past, maybe in olden times, you know, 30, 40 years ago, when these titles had some meaning, people might have attached something to that. But like I think Zaid said, the titles, there's too many people with these honorifics, and it has devalued itself. And I think in the situation that we've seen now going forward, the titles don't really figure very much in terms of whether people see that candidate or that politician positively or otherwise. But however, what we do notice when we encounter people that are in the community, there is a great desire to have a title because it symbolizes an achievement for the individual. It gives a certain standing or status over others, and that perhaps allows them to get something extra, a business deal perhaps, greater respectability, you know, something shiny to put on the front of the car, you know, something like that.
Yeah,
state
you know,
the symbols.
I know what I think is quite amazing is the way in which people have come to, who get these titles, inhabit that identity so seriously that they refer to themselves as Dato or Daten. You know, Daten would like to go or Dato would like to go to the supermarket
yeah,
right now.
Yeah, and sometimes the titles are conferred on their children as well in the identity cards, you know.
Also. That, Kus, is an interesting innovation on the part of Malaysians. We're going to be back with a deeper look at the conversation around the upcoming budget. Stay tuned for that. This is Let's Talk with Sharad Khatun. Welcome back. I'm Sharad Khatun, and this is a Let's Talk, a show that brings you the most important conversations of the day. We're talking about the perceptions that people have, and there are many different types of people in Malaysia, of a government, especially in terms of the management of the economy. And we're going to be speaking to Ben Safid, who's in the room, who's been in the room with me for since the start of the show. Ben, of course, with Merdeka Center. Ben, the upcoming budget is a big deal. The Finance Minister, Lim Guan Eng, has come out to say that this is going to be a budget that will require sacrifices. The Prime Minister has made such... The language of sacrifice is a very interesting thing because it requires political work to be sold in a democratic society to a population. How do you think this is going to play with the population? It's not going to be as we usually have with budgets. Oh, this is a kind of, you know, Santa Claus has come around and is going to be giving out goodies. There are going to be very few presents and goodies this time.
Well, I mean, this is the first budget of this new government. But it also, like in the case of previous instances, the first budget after the election. And typically, you know, the goodies have already been doled out. And this particular round, the government is cutting back in order to trim the deficit. And also, I think in the case of this new government, it's to make good on its promise to rein in excesses in government and also reform some of the irregularities and things that have gone wayward in the past. So I think the language that has come out from our Minister of Finance and also Prime Minister is actually to condition the public to manage their expectations as the country goes into this first budget. I think a lot of the items that has hit the news cycle has been about wastage, has been about abuses in the past. And we've also seen situations where contracted government employees have already been, you know, sent home. So that, I think, is a signal that there is probably going to be some cuts and changes in the way things are going to be spent in government.
Now, you know, what is interesting, because it's us who watch this space, whose jobs are, in fact, to keep a finger on the pulse of government and, you know, and listen very carefully to the messages they telegraph, is that we are aware that there's a long runway up to the budget, right? The question is for the ordinary person who doesn't watch the space as much, you know, will they be shocked when budget day comes that, in fact, many of the programs they've relied on might, in fact, be on the chopping block?
Well, and if you look at how the government budget eventually reaches or trickles down to the person on the street, what we've noticed is that in the last several years, many people are concerned about the things that hit them directly. So I think many households, many people are going to be keen to see, you know, what happened with the new iteration of BRIM, you know, this Bantuan Rakyat One Malaysia. Is it still going to be doled out? Will the amounts be changed? I think people expect to see a continuation of that. The second things would be assistance for education, for agriculture, for people in businesses. There's questions about will the government continue giving out grants for things related to technology and startups, for example, which is, I think, critical to generate new growth areas in our economy. So those are things that people are looking at. The other areas that people are looking at concerns over the development expenditure. What we've noticed in the past administration is that year on year, the proportion of the government budget allocated for development keeps shrinking, you know, right, by the year.
Right, as opposed to the operations,
budget.
Yeah, but again, you know, for me, the interesting thing is, you know, last year we had a whopper of a budget under the Najib administration. It was like he went out with a bang. It was 280 billion ringgit. This time it's going to be significantly less. And I know analysts are looking at this as in positive terms, right? They see this as an opportunity for reform, for fiscal discipline, for, you know, plugging the leakages, for creating a much more efficient system. All good things. But they are going to be hard and bitter pills for people to swallow. And, you know, you, when you do your work, you know that people are sensitive to certain things. Some things that might be much more bitter are easy to swallow, and those are less bitter. But still, what do you think will be the hot potatoes coming out of this, you know, the scenario with the budget that's slated for the 2nd of November?
Well, I think if we want to simplify looking at these things, there are three important areas. You know, number one is people in the government itself, the government machinery, the bureaucrats and the public servants who are inside government and constitute a large proportion of our workforce. What's in store for them? Will there be cuts or any adjustments to the kind of perks or benefits that they have enjoyed in the past? Number two, with respect to the general public out there, the types of services, will there be any changes in the kind of services that they are getting? And I think here, if we look at maybe the top two or three important services, you know, education. How will the education budget be under this new administration? Will there be an improvement? Will there be cuts, for example, in university allocations and schools, for example? Will there be any serious adjustments there, you know, downward adjustments there? That's going to materially affect, you know, parents and students who are in the system. And I think the third area would be in the area of development, for example, because, you know, a substantial element of our economy subsists on public expenditure, public procurement. So how will that area be going into the future? I think the public and also the business community expects things to be done much more differently now, more open tender, more competition in order to get the jobs. But will it be run more smoothly? Will there be things that need to be ironed out as things move forward? And will there be any changes in the commitments of the previous administration with respect to new projects or variations of existing ones?
I wonder if you can test for this, the question of patience. Do people have the patience to let government do, you know, the necessary? The finance minister has come out to say that it'll take 3 years to kind of get everything out, sort things out, right? They've painted a scenario of a government, at least when it comes to our coffers, in crisis. Do people actually buy that? Do they, and will they then respond by saying, okay, 3 years, because 3 years is a long time in politics. It's a long time for a household that's struggling, perhaps, to put food on the table.
No, there is a possibility for them to do so, but I think it all hinges on authenticity and also empathy with members of the public. And when I say authenticity, they cannot make things up to be worse than what it really is. I think they have to tell people roughly the truth, but not to the point that it scares the markets and move investors away. But at the same time, they also have to empathize with members of the public. And that means they cannot lead ostentatious lifestyles. They cannot waste public funds meaninglessly, you know. And so the government officials need to embody the value system that they want the public
to. Do you think they're ready to do that? I mean, have you seen evidence that this is what they're prepared to do?
To some extent, yes. You know, in the new government, you know, you do see some of the new statements that came out. And like, I think a few days ago, you know, Azmin mentioned that in the new rules, you know, ministers are not allowed to bring a large entourage when they go on overseas trips. They get only limited to two officials. They cannot bring their spouses and so on. I think those are statements in the right direction. So people actually welcome that. And so if the government is making its own set of sacrifices, I think that's fine. But if they start, you know, in a space of time being lavish again, the huge banquets and so on, I think people will get upset, and then people won't buy this idea of sacrifice.
Okay, we'll be hold that thought. We'll be right back with a deeper look at the minimum wage. Some people say it's solving that problem is a solution to the crisis that we seem to have in our economy. This is Let's Talk with me, Sharad Khatun. Welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Khatun. With me in the studio is Ben Sufian from Madeka Center. We're talking about perceptions of government and especially its management of the economy. Now, there'll be a protest starts at Padang Merbau and it's going to be all going all the way to Parliament, just across the little hump there. And the protesters are part of something called Gabungan Banta 1050, which is a reference to the 1,050 ringgit minimum wage that was announced. Now, this constitutes a 50 ringgit increase in the peninsula and 130 ringgit increase in Sabah and Sarawak. On the line, we have Arul Chelvan, who's part of the coalition that's presenting this memorandum. Arul, thank you so much for joining us this evening. I want to begin, before we get into the details of the memorandum and also the protest tomorrow, can I ask you a very simple question? Who earns less than 1,050 ringgit in this country today?
Actually, the numbers are very small. If you look at our statistics, it would say that 1.07% of Malaysians would earn less than 1,050.
So if that's the case, then what is the real issue? I mean, if the reality of wages is higher than the 1,050, why are we quibbling about that amount?
Because I think the employers have a very strong lobby, and they are the ones who keep saying that the economy will collapse, and I don't know why the Pakatan Harapan government is buying to this. Because all this while, every time there's a talk about increase in the minimum wage, they come very strongly saying that the economy will collapse, investors will run away. But in fact, statistics will show us that Indonesia, Thailand, and Philippines have a higher minimum wage than Malaysia. And you know, and our purchasing power is the lowest in ASEAN. So it's actually quite a serious situation. And Khazanah report today, you know, yesterday and in the papers today, is really telling because it says that, you know, 95% of the B40 spend their money in consumer goods and they end up having about 70 ringgit. This is even lower than what Sophia and the Merdeka Center predicted in 2017 November. You know, he said they would have about 500, but now it is even less than that.
Now, you know, in an article written by a member of the Socialist Party, the former MP for Sungai Siput, Dr. Michael Jayakumar, he says that the National Wages Council recommends something of the magnitude of 1,170 ringgit. Why do you think that the government has ignored the recommendations of the National Wages Council?
Actually, this is exactly why the protest is tomorrow. We want them to make it public because you see that the technical committee... It's quite an independent committee. I mean, they have members from the employers as well as the trade unions. And if you look at what they look into inflation, they look into productivity, they look into unemployment. So, of course, the employers wanted, the workers, the union wanted 1,800. But what we are really disappointed is the government, the cabinet took 1,050, was exactly the amount proposed by the employers' association. The Employees Association requested 1,050 starting from January 1st next year. And that's exactly what the cabinet announced. And I think it's against what the council, you know, the wage technical committee recommended. And I think that is why we want this technical committee report to be made public. Because if you make that report public, it will show that you must pay them at least more than 1,170.
No, right. I mean, there's another dimension to the problem, Arul. I'd like you to help me understand this, which is that how does government enforce a minimum wage? So many people work in small or medium-sized businesses. Are they already complying with labour laws in this country? And to add to that minimum wage, would government have the wherewithal to monitor the situation, and also do the workers themselves understand their rights and what kind of organizing capacity do they have in order to assert their rights in these kinds of industries?
You see, from 2012, it has been a law. You know, and this law, minimum wage was included because market mechanism did not work. The government then said we need minimum wage because wages in this country have been suppressed. 1.3 million people were earning below poverty line. That was the rationale when this law was enacted in 2012 and implemented in 2013. So in 2013, you have those who pay below the minimum wage can be taken to court. And a number of them have been successfully been prosecuted. And PSM, we ourselves have filed a lot of cases and we have won. And after that, workers have got their minimum wage. And employers can get an exemption if the employee agrees for a lower wage. That means if an employee says, I'm willing to take a lower wage with a letter, that is also allowed. So in that sense, this every 2 years, they have to, so they form a committee, you know, and this committee will advise the cabinet on how much should be the minimum wage be. And what does this committee look into? They look into everything. They look into productivity, because a lot of people now argue, oh, workers must increase their productivity. Correct. This committee looks into productivity. They look into unemployment rate, medium range. They look into everything, you know, and then they come out with a recommendation and they pass it to the cabinet. The cabinet then decides, makes the announcement. But here, we are strongly disappointed because the cabinet did not follow what this committee wanted. That is why we are asking this committee, this report to be made public. Because currently it is under the Official Secret Act. That's what the committee doesn't want to say it out. But we want the government, the Pakatan Harapan government, who is supposed to be more transparent, to make this report public.
Yeah, Aru, lastly, tell us a little bit about who's going to be there at the protest. Is this a purely symbolic gesture, or is there going to be a show of force? Are you going to bring many people out tomorrow morning?
I think this is going to be the most significant protest since the new government, because it's going to be led by MTUC. And the last time the MTUC did a demo at Parliament was 10 years ago. So MTUC is mobilizing its members. And a lot of student movement, NGOs, there are so far 64 organizations have endorsed this memorandum. It's going to be a working day. We fear the rain more than the police tomorrow. We are worried it might fall heavily, but then we think that we will have significant numbers tomorrow marching from Padang Merbau to Parliament at 10 o'clock.
Okay, thank you so much, Arul. That was Arul Chelvin. He's a member of the Coalition Against the Minimum Wage set at 1,500. Gabungan Bantah 1,050. Ben, you know, very interesting statement that Arul made there about the idea that government is actually captive of the interests of a certain group, in this case, employers. Do you think that's a perception that people have, that there are these lobby groups, that there are these hands pulling at and shaping the interests of government?
Well, I think it's a democratic system now, and people in government will have to listen to many sides in order to get this policy done. And at the same time, you know, the government is also mindful that it needs all sectors of the economy, labour as well as capital, to work together and pull the country out. Not just from the situation that it's in right now, but also to achieve the long-term goal of becoming a high-income, purchasing capability economy. And I think, therefore, there's always going to be voices of people advocating for their point of view. I think with respect to this issue of the minimum wage, what we've noticed is that the Human Resource Minister did say that, you know, it's going to be a gradual step leading to the 1,500 ringgit minimum wage level that they touted in the lead-up to the election. I understand that it's going to be gradual. But at the same time, I think the movement by the workers' segment, I think, is important in order to keep the government in check so that they are always reminded of their promises. And at the same time, businesses too need to adjust. I think businesses need time to adjust because the external climate out there is a bit uncertain with the trade war, with also the projections that our economy is slowing down. I think all of this needs to be taken in consideration to not just cater to one segment.
Right, because we'll come back with a look also. I think the identity issues and to what extent people are driven by their economic interests. That's going to be the subject of what we're going to be talking about when we come back from this break. Stay tuned. This is Let's Talk with Sharad Kutan. Hi, and welcome back to Let's Talk. I'm Sharad Kutan. With me, Ben Sofian from Merdeka Center. We're talking about the perception of government in terms of its management of the economy. We heard earlier from Arup Chelvin from the Gabungan Banta Seribu Limapulo, which is all about wages, because wages are a crucial and central part of that report that came out from Khazanah Research Institute on the state of households. So low, wages are so low that some households have less than 100 ringgit at the end of the month to actually put away. I think, you know, there's been a conversation that's been going for some years now about economic vulnerability. We see that, you know, BRIM and the helicopter money that it represents really helps people because it's not that they're in poverty, but they're actually vulnerable. That any major, crisis in terms of money, the medical crisis, whatever, would really send them off the tracks. And so the question is, how do they read that? Do they see this as a problem of the lack of capacity on them that is their own responsibility? Do they blame government? Do they seek now to go to a trade union to represent them? Or do they go to a political party? Does any of our research tell us how Malaysians are calculating or how Malaysians are assimilating and understanding their own situation?
Well, we've fortunately been able to look at this. In the years past, we've done surveys that look at people's economic values and who they ascribe responsibility for economic policies that ultimately affect their own households and their own lives. What we've noticed is that I think in Malaysia, most people are favouring big government, governments that extend assistance all the way down to the households. And that is partly because of the history of the country, the social history of the country, as well as its own social economic background. I mean, we started out from an agrarian society that slowly industrialized, and now we are where we are, somewhat stuck in the middle income trap and trying to escape it, right?
Right, so people you say most people favour a big government that is, that comes in like a welfare state, basically,
yes,
or some form of a welfarist policy.
Yeah, so people expect that the government should intervene in order to set things right, some kind of economic justice intervention by government. And the government has actually done this in the past through schemes like FELDA and financial assistance for Bumiputra and other low-income business people. And over the years, we've seen the scheme transform into things that support technology development and things like that. So people have always had government in mind when they are in need. But the reality of the situation is that most people escape this in the sense that the government cannot help everyone. But substantive numbers of people then seek avenues to get the attention of the government. And back in the day, the easiest one was you join the ruling party, And then when you're there, you get small jobs, and then that keeps your little business running. And that's how things have been.
But what about the question of trade unions? This is, a collective that's formed out of, common interests, in this case, economic interests. We're talking about the protest of the MTUC, the Malaysian Trade Union Congress, is supposed to be one of the main organisers. But can they even bring up the numbers? Levels of unionisation in this country is very low. I think they represent less than 10% of the population. Do you think there's something ideological or cultural that stops people from organising around their economic interests rather than seeking patronage through political parties, through, a friendly dato and so on and so forth? And they are friendly datos.
Of course.
Like, maybe too many.
I think if you look at what's happened in the history of the labour movement here, I think the labour movement never really got a chance to flourish, partly because as the country went into rapid industrialization, the government used its powers in order to limit the voice of the workers and keep the wages low so that the country's economic engine continue humming. And so the labour movement never really had a chance to grow and become a very potent political force. But be that as it may, this affected workers, not just people in the industrial sector, but people in the agriculture sector, has always had an avenue to vent their dissatisfaction through political parties. So I think, as an example, if we look at voting patterns, for example, that's something that we love doing. We've noticed that, let's say, rural areas, you know, agricultural areas, we find that voters who live outside of, say, an irrigation scheme tend to be more likely than those who live within an irrigation scheme to vote for the ruling party back in the day. So people have always had, one way or another, an avenue to vent their dissatisfaction. The question is the effectiveness and the efficiency of those modes. And because people tend to push their agenda through political parties, you know, it takes a long time. Okay, election cycles are every 5 years.
Yeah, and because we've had an extraordinary election round this time, in people who had economically disaffected perhaps voted for Pakatan Harapan hoping that their problems would be solved. Now Pakatan Harapan is the government, and if they fail to represent those interests, if they fail to actually manage the everyday for most ordinary Malaysians, where do people turn to? Will they go back to Barisan Nasional? Will Barisan Nasional and PAS become the new champions of the poor? And will people believe it?
Well, you know, at this point in time, you know, Barisan Nasional is a bit, or not a bit, quite discredited, you know, because it hasn't really gone through a full transition. It hasn't cycled out the old leaders that led them into the defeat. I suppose in time to come, if they are able to present a new, more credible lineup of people, they might be able to garner support. But what we've seen in the recent developments, particularly in, say, just the Port Dickson by-election last weekend, is that some segments of the people are flocking to PAS, you know, and largely perhaps as a protest vote against Pakatan Harapan. It may not be completely effective at a national level, but certainly, you know, there's always an avenue for people to go to, even though it is less efficient than actually putting your voice through a labour organisation and then negotiating with employers and people in government.
Do you think kind of the scenario going forward for the Pakatan Harapan government is going to be a difficult one? I mean, what do you think are going to be the major, you know, time bombs or, you know, if for them moving forward?
Well, I think the most critical element, you know, for them moving forward is convincing the members of the public that the measures that they're going to take with respect to government spending and managing the economy is going to lead into medium-term growth. I mean, they've already signaled that not to expect short-term growth and short-term gains. The hope is that these reforms will translate into tangible improvements in people's livelihoods. I think if they can truly transform, let's say, the government procurement process and allow more people access, people who qualify access to get jobs from government, for example, or contracts from government, I think that's going to assuage a certain segment of the public.
Small businesses and
small businesses, small contractors, and allow the chatter to spread so that people then have a sense that this, there's, well, we are not getting a lot, but it's fair and nobody is getting ahead or getting advantage ahead of us. I think that's the first step. So to introduce a new culture of competition and fair play in the business situation. And second, within the wider public, and I think this is why the business of reform is critical, to create a new value system that promotes ethical behaviour in government, in politics, and so on. I think it's a long-term project.
And, you know, it's a fascinating one because there seems to be always a kind of lag, right? You can do all the institutional reforms, you can make the arguments, but people have to be brought along with you, especially if you believe in democracy. You have to persuade them, don't you?
Yeah, certainly. And I think the government has a bit of space. So when we talk about the goodwill that they've created after the general election, they have a bit of time and they need to use this well in order to get those reforms done. And hopefully those reforms then generate the kind of economic growth that then transfers some wealth to the public. And then we are hit with the next election cycle again. So they need to move really fast.
Okay, we have unfortunately have run out of time. Thank you so much, Ben, for being here. I've been speaking to Ben Sufian from Merdeka Center. Of course, also on the line we had earlier, Rochelle from Gabungan Bantah 1050 and also Zaid Malik from Lawyers for Liberty. Thank you so much for joining me this evening on Let's Talk, the show that brings you the most important conversations of the day, only on Astro Awani, every night at 10 p.m.